Welcome to Between the Lines, presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. I'm Scott Harris. This week we present Andreina Chavez, a reporter based in Caracas, and Steve Elner, an editor with Latin American Perspectives, who discussed Donald Trump's kidnapping of Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro and the central role of oil in the attack. Trita Parsi of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, who assesses the danger of a wider regional war if Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu convinces Donald Trump to join Israel in launching a new war with Iran. And Lynn Stoddard, an activist with Third Act, who talks about the group's Simplify Solar National campaign to make residential rooftop solar energy more affordable and easier to install. But first, we begin with a summary of some of the week's underreported news stories.
The decade-long civil war in Yemen entered a dangerous new phase as Saudi Arabia attacked a United Arab Emirates shipment of weapons and military equipment sent to UAE-allied separatist rebels in late December. The airstrike, which destroyed 80 military vehicles, was aimed at eliminating UAE support for the Southern Transition Council, or STC, which is seeking to restore South Yemen as an independent state. The Saudi attack responded to weeks of STC military advances into much of oil-rich eastern Yemen, which shares a 1,000-mile border with Saudi Arabia. The Saudis and the UAE support competing forces that are loosely aligned against the Iran-backed Houthi rebels who took control of the nation's capital, Sana'a, in 2015. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres warned that full-scale fighting in Yemen could destabilize the entire Red Sea region. He urged a de-escalation of the conflict. The Yemen war has thus far killed an estimated 377,000 people, and nearly half the population faces hunger due to the continuing civil war. After weeks of border clashes between Thailand and Cambodia in December, the two nations agreed to a short-term ceasefire on December 27th. The agreement followed a breakdown of an earlier ceasefire deal that U.S. President Donald Trump and Malaysian Prime Minister Anwar Ibrahim brokered to halt a previous border conflict in July. During the hostilities, the Thai military reportedly launched airstrikes targeting Cambodian border casinos and suspected online fraud centers that news reports say regularly cheat Thai citizens out of $3.5 billion annually. Observers say that the attacks put human trafficking victims inside the Cambodian compounds at risk. Cambodia's online fraud networks are notorious for luring overseas workers with offers of legitimate jobs, then forcing them, under threat of violence and torture, to scam Southeast Asian victims. The recent border clash that killed 100 people and displaced some 500,000 on both sides originated over disputed borders imposed by colonial powers France and the United Kingdom in 1907. With an abundance of sunshine and wind, New Mexico could become a mecca of clean, renewable energy, with enough of a surplus to supply electricity to Arizona and California. But instead, consumer and clean energy advocates warn that the state has become a battleground for private equity groups bidding to use the state's natural resources to power new data centers that are needed to provide enormous amounts of electricity to expand the artificial intelligence industry. Blackstone, the world's largest private equity firm, is seeking to purchase the utility TXNM Energy for $11.5 billion. If the deal is approved by the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission, or FERC, it would give Blackstone control over Texas-New Mexico Power and Public Service Company, which serves over 800,000 electric customers. Blackstone is offering to pay a 23% acquisition premium over book value to buy TXNM. Mariel Nanasi, executive director and president of New Energy Economy, says Blackstone's proposed acquisition threatens to harm ratepayers. By prioritizing construction of new data centers across New Mexico, rather than supplying affordable power to the utility's 800,000 electric customers. This week's news summary was compiled by Bob Nixon. For Between the Lines, I'm Anna Manzo.
In the early morning hours of January 3rd, President Trump illegally ordered the U.S. military to bomb army bases near Venezuela's capital, Caracas, and kidnap the nation's president, Nicolas Maduro, and his wife, Celia Flores, who were then flown to the U.S. to face criminal charges of narco-terrorism and weapons offenses. In a New York City courtroom, Maduro and his wife pled not guilty to the charges, with Maduro declaring that he was a kidnapped president and a prisoner of war. At a press conference held later to discuss his order to abduct President Maduro, Trump repeated the false claim that Venezuela had stolen America's oil that justified, in his mind, his stated intention to turn over the world's largest proven crude oil reserves to U.S. oil companies. Addressing questions about Venezuelan opposition leader, Nobel Prize laureate Maria Corina Machado, Trump said, quote, "She doesn't have the support or the respect within the country." Appearing drunk with power after his military success, Trump then threatened unspecified future military action against Colombia, Cuba, Greenland, Iran, and Mexico. Your reporter spoke with Andreina Chavez, a reporter based in Caracas, and Steve Elner, an editor with Latin American Perspectives, who discuss the current uncertain political situation in Venezuela and the true history of U.S. oil companies' investments in the country that were partially compensated after the government nationalized the fossil fuel industry in 1976. We hear first from Andreina on the deaths resulting from the U.S. attack.
So we have reports that at least 80 people were killed in these attacks. We have confirmation from the Cuban government and the Venezuelan government that 32 Cuban nationals were killed defending President Maduro and defending Venezuela against the U.S. attacks. We have the name of at least one of the civilians who died because of the U.S. bombing, 80-year-old woman. Her name is Rosa Gonzalez. She died during the U.S. bombings in La Catia La Mar. We also know that at least another person in El Atillo, Miranda State, also died because of the U.S. bombings. And the information right now, it is still ongoing. We're still trying to understand exactly the damage that the U.S. bombs actually affected. The Venezuelan population has suffered because of these attacks. It is completely untrue, but the Trump administration is saying that everything was a surgical operation, that everything was successful, that nobody was harmed. Venezuelan people were harmed, and that is a fact.
Andreina, I did want to ask you about what the opposition leaders are saying in Venezuela in response to the U.S. attack and abduction of President Maduro. Given the fact that Donald Trump had some unexpected words to say about opposition leader Maria Corina Machado, saying she wasn't qualified or respected enough to lead Venezuela, that rubbed a lot of Venezuelan exiles here in the United States the wrong way. I'm certain that the opposition is also divided about that comment from Trump. What can you tell us about the opposition groups and what they're saying or not saying in this current moment of crisis?
You have to understand that once Trump said that Maria Corina Machado did not have the support of the Venezuelan people, that she was not qualified to be the leader, that was a hard blow for her, for the entire radical opposition in Venezuela. So the opposition has been very quiet in that sense. Other sectors of the Venezuelan opposition who are not with Maria Corina Machado, they are actually against Maria Corina Machado. They are more centrist, and they reject U.S. intervention. They understand the need to defend Venezuelan sovereignty, and they are not supporting the U.S. attacks against Venezuela. But like I said, the radical opposition in Venezuela, the one that has been calling for a U.S. invasion or intervention in Venezuela, they were hit really hard when Trump said that she was not qualified. Maria Corina Machado has never had popular support inside Venezuela.
Thank you, Andreina. Steve, we only have a few minutes left, and I wanted to ask you this final question. Assess for us the state of the oil industry inside Venezuela and Trump's declaration that the U.S. owns Venezuela's oil and charges that the U.S. oil companies are owed billions of dollars. And there's been news reports that Trump has told the U.S. oil companies to get back into Venezuela and start pumping oil again, although that's a project that might take many years.
Well, you know, Shad, it demonstrates complete ignorance about Venezuelan legislation. Venezuelan legislation, like the rest of much of Latin America, but in the case of Venezuela, going back to Simon Bolivar and the struggle for independence, the soil and the subsoil belongs to the nation. That's a fundamental principle in Venezuela law, and the oil companies knew that. I mean, they invested in Venezuela knowing full well that they were not owning the land. Now, Trump is saying that Venezuela has to give back the land and the oil, but the fact of the matter is that the land never belonged to them. Secondly, he states that the oil was robbed, was taken from the oil company, but the fact of the matter is that at no point did the government reject the idea of a compensation. The oil was nationalized in 1976, and the oil companies were compensated. Chavez renationalized the oil industry, and the same thing happened. Now, that happened, that was in 2007. Some changes were made, one of which was that the employees were transferred to the payroll of the state oil company. Chevron accepted that. They stayed. Exxon and ConocoPhillips left, but they weren't forced out of Venezuela. This is stated time and time again. Those two oil companies left Venezuela of their own accord. They were not expelled from Venezuela. More recently, Maduro was in negotiations with ConocoPhillips, and there was a possibility that they would reinvest in Venezuela again. But that is simply not true, that the oil was taken from the United States. And this narrative that the United States built the oil industry, I mean, these were Venezuelans who were performing that. Venezuelans who listened to that narrative, that listened to Trump's talk, just goes against the sense of pride and nationalism, because the oil industry was all about Venezuelans. It was the result of the effort of Venezuelans, and the idea that it was the United States that built the industry is deceptive.
That was Andreina Chavez, a reporter based in Caracas, and Steve Elner, associate managing editor of Latin American Perspectives. Find more news and analysis on Trump's military operation that kidnapped Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. In recent weeks, major protests have erupted in Iran, initially over economic issues, including high inflation and the devaluation of Iran's currency, the rial. As demonstrations have spread across the country, an estimated 29 protesters have been killed and 1,200 have been arrested in clashes with police. But several Iranian officials, including President Masoud Pezeshkian and Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, have publicly acknowledged that protesters have legitimate grievances and demands related to the nation's economic crisis. But just one day before the U.S. launched a military attack on Venezuela to kidnap that nation's president, Nicolas Maduro, Donald Trump took note of the protests in Iran and posted a note in his social media account warning that if Iran kills peaceful protesters, the U.S. will come to their rescue. Just days earlier, Trump welcomed Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to the White House, where the two leaders reportedly discussed the possibility of launching new attacks on Iran in order to prevent Tehran from rebuilding its capabilities after the joint U.S.-Israeli air attacks in June. Your reporter spoke with Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft, who discusses the danger of a wider regional war if Netanyahu convinces Trump to join Israel in launching a new war against Iran.
So the Iranian economy has been in a very bad state for quite some time, and it's a combination of mismanagement, corruption, but most importantly, oftentimes, the impact of sanctions. I mean, the currency has been going down steadily, but now there was a huge drop, and that prompted sporadic protests by people in the Iranian bazaar, traders, etc. Their livelihood is blowing up. They simply cannot do business when the currency is so volatile and unprotected. This, to a very large extent, is the result of sanctions because the Iranians do not have access to roughly $120 billion of their own reserves as a result of financial sanctions preventing them from being able to access those money. That's the result of financial sanctions the U.S. has imposed. And it's precisely those type of reserves that are needed in order to be able to protect the currency against speculation, etc. And so in this specific case, the sanctions did play a very critical role. But what so oftentimes happens is that you have protests beginning over one issue, but in a society that by and large is so unhappy with the political situation, which is the case in Iran, it quickly tends to morph into other forms of protests on other grounds. And we saw that after a day or so that it really shifted towards protests against the regime as a whole.
So after meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last week, Trump has issued a threat to attack Iran again. And this is after the U.S. and Israel launched attacks last June targeting the Islamic Republic's nuclear facilities. Trump said that the U.S. is locked and loaded, I think is the quote, if more Iranian protesters died. Trita, what do you make of this threat? We've seen other Trump threats in recent days targeting Denmark and Greenland, Panama, Colombia. What does this say about Trump and where he intends to take U.S. policy regarding Iran?
Well, that tweet, as well as tweets that he issued today, comes after him spending 2.5 days with Netanyahu, who came, the Israeli prime minister, who came to the U.S. on December 29th for meetings with Trump. And the top of the agenda was the Israeli demand for yet another war with Iran. And Trump's comment after some of those meetings was that he essentially appeared to publicly give a green light for the Israelis to attack again, and that the basis of the attack no longer needed to be the nuclear program, but rather also Iran's missile capabilities. The Israelis did not manage to achieve their objectives in the summer war that they launched in June of this past year. And this is part of the reason why they want to go to war again. But they simply cannot do anything effectively without U.S. support. They absolutely need U.S. support in order to protect Israel against Iran's retaliatory missiles. And even with U.S. support, a very large number of those missiles went through the Israeli air defense systems. But it's precisely because the Iranians do have the capacity of retaliating against Israel that the Israelis want to go to war again and eliminate not only that capability, but any capability the Iranians may have that enables the Iranians to challenge Israel's growing domination in the region. And I think that's really the core issue that this is about. Now, in that context, we see suddenly how Trump starts to speak the language of regime change, even though earlier on, of course, he had been very explicit that he's against regime change wars, that he's against all of these different, what he called neoconservative or neocon policies that the U.S. pursued under the Bush administration, for instance. But just today, he explicitly said that regime change is not a popular word, but why shouldn't there be regime change in Iran? So much indicates that the U.S. is actually getting ready to support Israel or actively participate in another strike on Iran with the aim of regime collapse at a minimum, as well as taking out much of Iran's military capability. The Iranians clearly know they're gonna lose a war against the United States. So they're going to do everything they can to avoid it. But there comes a point in which they feel that they have their backs completely against the wall. And at that point, they will have no other choice but to fight back. And I think if Trump is signaling that his aim is regime change, at that point, there really isn't any de-escalatory ladder there is no exit ramp for the Iranians to be able to do just a performative retaliation. And that may force them into a position in which they actually would use a lot of their capabilities, not just against Israel, but against the U.S. as well. So we may very well end up getting bogged down in yet another needless war of choice in the Middle East.
That was Trita Parsi, Executive Vice President of the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft and author of Losing an Enemy, Obama, Iran, and the Triumph of Diplomacy. Find more news and commentary on a possible new U.S. war with Iran by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. Third Act is a national organization of American activists over the age of 60, focusing on the issues of climate and democracy. The group was founded by author and climate activist Bill McKibben, whose 2025 book titled Here Comes the Sun extols the value of solar energy for providing affordable carbon-free power and the importance of making this renewable energy source accessible to everyone in the world. A related new initiative to expand the use of solar power is Third Act's nationwide project called Simplify Solar, a campaign to make residential rooftop solar more affordable. Between the Lines' Melinda Tuhu spoke with Lynn Stoddard, who's helping to coordinate the Simplify Solar campaign in Connecticut. Here she discusses the effort to educate local building inspectors and elected officials on a new phone app that streamlines the permitting process for rooftop solar, which makes this green technology more affordable.
Simplify Solar is a campaign organized by Third Act National all across the country, and it's based on the premise that rooftop residential solar is 2 to 3 times as expensive in the United States as it is in Germany, some European countries, and Australia. And the major reason for this is what they call the soft costs, which are the permitting costs. In Australia, you can get a permit like within a day for a simple rooftop solar installation. In the US, it can take weeks, months, or more. And so those delays incur costs for the homeowner, for the staff that's doing tedious reviews at the local level. And so Simplify Solar is an acknowledgement that we have some leverage at our local permitting level to try to make solar permitting more simple and straightforward. And there's some great tools for that. So that's what we're hoping to educate people about and get them engaged with through the campaign.
How does that work? Because if it's a national campaign, aren't requirements different like all over the place? How does this tool, and maybe you could say more about the tool, how does that tool work?
Requirements are different. We're trying to intervene at that level, but there are some simple things that are similar. So typically an installer or a homeowner submits for a permit, and then there's, you know, review period by the jurisdiction, the town or whoever. One of these tools that we're going to be educating people about is called the Solar App Plus. And it's basically a platform that was developed by the National Renewable Energy Lab. So our tax dollars at work through this U.S. Department of Energy lab over the course of years, involving local building officials, solar installers, experts in solar panel design and so on, and the researchers at the lab there, looking at like what are the things that building departments look at to approve a permit on a residential roof. So they have built this amazing online platform that includes like constantly updated electrical codes, building codes for all the states. And then you can layer on any things that are customized for a specific region, like load on a roof from snow or something like that, in addition to the panels, or the wind in a given area. There's this platform that incorporates all these things, and those are what the building official is looking at during the permitting, like, okay, does it meet the electric code? Does it meet this and that? So what can happen now with solar app, and is happening in well over 300 towns and cities across the country already, is the town will say, yeah, I want to use solar app, this online automated permitting system. It's customized specifically for the town, and solar app, which is now run by a nonprofit, an installer can apply for a permit at any time of night. If you want to put solar on your roof, or your installer doesn't have to appear at your town hall at like between 10 and 2 on a Thursday or something like that, they could submit your permit at 2 in the morning. It's a standardized permit for your roof for anyone in any town using the solar app, and it's comparing it to this huge database of codes that are constantly updated and whatnot. Basically, the installer fills in the permit fields, and if it meets the code, you get a suddenly the permit like is automated and is granted. It frees up the building inspector's time of training on all the codes, checking all the codes, reviewing each permit against these books of codes and whatnot, and generates an inspection list so that when that town is ready to go out and the solar has been installed, they're ready to go out and inspect it so it can be hooked up to the electrical system and given the go ahead. That's the time that the building official is spending. They're doing that now. They're doing the building review and the inspection, but this basically focuses their time on the inspection with a very targeted list that's already been teased out from the permit application. So this tool can be used across the country. It gets customized a little bit depending on the region and the location. It's free to towns, which is amazing. Installers pay like $25. So it can also reduce permitting fees. It can make a town, like if you have a new building official, the training and coming up to speed on all these things is handled through the solar app platform. It speeds up the process. You could get the permit within a day.
That was Lynn Stoddard, co-coordinator of Third Act Simplify Solar Campaign in Connecticut. Learn more about this nationwide project by visiting our Between the Lines website at btlonline.org. You've been listening to Between the Lines, a weekly program presenting news and analysis of critical issues affecting our communities, the nation, and the world. Between the Lines is produced and distributed by Squeaky Wheel Productions. If you have suggestions for topics and guests, please contact Between the Lines through our website at btlonline.org, where you can hear our current and archive programs in streaming audio and support our show. There you can also subscribe to free weekly podcasts, program summaries, and interview transcripts. Follow us on Facebook at Between the Lines Radio News Magazine and on Blue Sky at BTL Radio News. Thanks for listening on WRFN in Nashville, Tennessee, KMUD in Eureka, California, Global Community Radio nationwide, dozens of other community radio stations across the U.S. and abroad, and wherever you get your favorite podcasts. Our theme music was written by Richard Hill and performed by Mikata. This week's program was produced by Susan Bramhall, Mary Hunt, Anna Manzo, Bob Nixon, Melinda Tuhus, and Jeff Yates. For Between the Lines, I'm Scott Harris.